Welcome to the Deadcast.
Friday, December 31st, 1993. It is a bitterly cold night in Humboldt, Nebraska. It's 27 degrees outside, and weather forecasters are calling for snow flurries later in the day. Two young men drive, their faces set and cruel with purpose. Somewhere ahead of them in the darkness is a farmhouse. They soon reach it and get out of the car. One of them is carrying a gun. They break into the house and find a young woman standing terrified in the bedroom. Her name is Lisa Lambert. They demand to know where her friend Brandon is, brandishing the gun at her. The gun, a .38, listens cruelly, its small black mouth seeming to reach out and want to envelop her. Lisa refuses to reveal the other's whereabouts. They grow enraged and tear through the house, finally dragging a thin, shaking young woman with short brown hair from beneath the bed. They ask Lisa if there's anyone else in the house. She replies, yes, there is. Philip Devine, who's dating another friend's sister. From the corner of the room, a young child, a toddler really, cries at the scene unfolding before him. The two men shoot each of the adults twice in the head, point-blank range, execution style. Later, the coroner would describe the shots as in and out, meaning they went in before exploding out another portion of the head. One of the men, Tom Nissen, notices that the target of their range, the young woman known as Brandon, is still twitching. He asks his accomplice, John Lauder, for a knife. Nissen then stabs Brandon in the chest, ensuring death. Neither of the men know it at the time, but the murders they have committed are to become infamous. With one documentary film and one Academy Award-winning film based off of it. For the young woman they had murdered was known to many as a man, and while her birth certificate might have borne the first name Tina, she would forever be known as Brandon Tina, and her murder, along with one other, would help shape the hate crime laws that are in existence in the United States today. Hello again, and welcome to the Deathcast. I am your host, best-selling independent author Ian Totten, and tonight we are going to be looking at the murder of Brandon Tina, a transgender man who was killed in the small town of Humboldt, Nebraska, on December 31st, 1993. Before we begin, I'd like to thank everyone who's been listening to the show and supporting it. We're now available on the Apple Podcasts app, so if you like what I do, please leave a 5-star review. They really do help. Also, if you'd like to support and follow the show, you can find me on Twitter under the name of @AuthorTotten, on Instagram under @AuthorTotten, on Facebook at Ian Totten Author, although I'm currently serving a 30-day ban, so I won't be able to interact with you until they release me from jail. And if you really like to help support the podcast, to help buy better equipment such as microphones and headsets, I am on Patreon at Ian Totten Author. That's enough of that. Now, let's go into the crypt. Later that morning, the bodies of Brandon Tina, Lisa Lambert, and Philip Devine were found. After Lisa's mother became concerned that she was not able to reach her daughter, we do know that it didn't take the police long to figure out who their main suspects were. Tom Nissen and his friend, John Lauder, had been accused of rape by Brandon Tina just a few short weeks beforehand, and it wasn't long before both men were located and apprehended. Now, I picked this week's story not because it's, you know, politically relevant, but because I first came across it about 10 years ago, and I'd never heard of it before then, but it's one of the most unsettling and tragic stories I've ever heard. And while it's largely remembered within the gay community, to the public at large, it seems as though this story has been somewhat forgotten under the push for gay rights, and I thought it would be fitting to flesh out what happened here and pay tribute to a young man who lost their life senselessly at the hands of two thugs. Before we get into the nitty-gritty of what happened, we're going to take a look at Brandon Tina, his life, his friends, relationships, and what ultimately led to his death. Brandon Tina was born as Tina Renee Brandon on December 12, 1972 in Lincoln, Nebraska, to the widowed wife of Patrick Bay Brandon, 16-year-old Joanne. Her father, a house painter named Patrick, had died 8 months beforehand in a car accident. Brandon had a fairly tumultuous childhood. He bounced around along with his older sister Tammy between the grandmother's house and living with their birth mother. At the age of 3, Brandon eventually did go to live with his mother full-time at the Pine Acre Mobile Home Park, which is located in northeastern Lincoln. Joanne at this point was 19 and was receiving disability checks as well as working in a retail store in town. Joanne had remarried the previous year, and by all accounts, neither of her children liked the man. Although, to be fair to the unnamed man, they really didn't have many other role models in their life who could be considered as positive. One of their uncles is known to have sexually molested both girls for a few years during this point. I could find no age at when it began or ended, but sexual abuse, much like rape, stays with the victim for the rest of their life. And being as young as Brandon was, I'm sure it was beyond horrific in that at that age, the individual being abused has no idea what's going on or why it's being done to them, only that they don't like it and it makes them feel ashamed. Whereas an older child, say in their mid-teens, understands the concepts behind it and will usually feel the same feelings as the younger child. Despite these hardships, Joanne did attempt to raise her children properly, telling an interviewer in 1995 that she bought them nice clothes and sent them to a Catholic school that was in town. For anybody who doesn't know, Catholic schools are fairly expensive. In fact, with the exception of the religious curriculum, they're pretty much private schools. The two girls have been described as being vastly different, with the older Tammy being considered prissy and popular. Brandon was considered awkward and shy, and most people that knew him said that he was a tomboy from a very young age. Brandon was seen by those at school as being socially awkward, and it's been said that he began to identify as a male during early adolescence, and even dated a female student during that period. His mother, Joanne, has and continues to deny the male identity and refer to Brandon as her daughter. And I've seen a few claims where Tina is said to have told people she was intersex, although there is no evidence that Brandon was born in this way. Brandon somehow made it through grade school, despite having what has been described as awful grades, and eventually made it into the 10th high school, which apparently had a very strict environment, which Brandon felt out of place in. During his second year in school, he's said to have rejected Christianity and would argue with her religion teacher, Father Fushinaro, regarding Christianity's views on abstinence and homosexuality. Apparently, this escalated as Brandon refused to adhere to the dress code, shunning the dresses the other women were made to wear, and instead wore slacks, a dress shirt, and a tie, while keeping his hair cut short. One article I read on the case said that Brandon was into weightlifting, and that although he had crushes on a few of the boys in the school, never attempted to date any of them. It seems that Brandon only had one real friend in school, a girl named Sarah who became pregnant. Apparently their friendship was so close that Brandon offered to help raise the baby, which of course was rejected. In 1990, during Brandon's senior year, an army recruiter came in and he was excited about joining but was unable to pass the entrance exam because where it said sex, Brandon wrote down male, which was obvious to anybody who'd had any interactions with him was not really the case. Brandon did go and hang out with people from the school, even attending dances, taping his breasts to his body to appear more masculine. I have read one anecdote that took place shortly before Brandon was to have graduated high school, wherein someone called the trailer by accident, and Brandon was surprised to find a girl on the other end. He chatted her up for a few minutes before hanging up, and not long after that, another phone call came in, at which time another girl said that she had been told a really hot-sounding guy lived there. A date was arranged, and Brandon, with Sarah in tow, went and met the girl, who was 13 at the time, at a local skating rink. According to Sarah, in 1995, Brandon just wanted to see if he could get away with it, and went through the entire night without being discovered. At this point, it should be noted that Brandon was posing under the name of Billy Brinson, and not long after this impromptu date, he began dating another of the girl's friends, this one named Heather, who was 14 at the time. This soon raised trouble in Brandon's life, as he had never been given much attention, and Heather fawned over him, causing Brandon to steal money from his mother so that he could buy Heather clothing and a stereo. They also apparently stole Heather's mother's credit card and cruised up and down the streets until early in the morning hours. This rebellious double life began to leak over into Brandon's regular life, and friends and classmates noticed a remarkable change in his personality, whereas before he had been shy and introverted, he was now extroverted and considered a class clown. It got to the point that he was failing classes so badly that just before graduation, Brandon was expelled from Pius X High School. Apparently, this was a major catalyst in Brandon's life, as once school was no longer there, he began spending all of his time as a man, going so far as to shave, stuff socks down the front of his pants, and use the men's room while out in public. His relationship with Heather had one hiccup early on, when Heather saw Brandon's driver's license. He quickly explained that the name Tino was an Irish name, but most people called him Brandon, and that he had made the name Billy up. Apparently the young girl bought this, later saying that it just seemed like something that he would do. He was always joking and making up stories. Tina eventually moved in with Heather and her mother, working odd jobs around town to help contribute to the house. Brandon's mother, Joanne, was massively displeased with this and began blaming Heather for what she considered a phase in her daughter's life, to the point that she and her daughter, Tammy, began trailing Brandon around town. Eventually, she convinced Brandon's friend, Sarah, to go and speak with Tina. As the story goes, Heather was on the phone when Sarah arrived with Brandon's birth certificate in hand. After explaining to the younger girl that Brandon was really a woman named Tina and showing the birth certificate, supposedly Heather feigned surprise and went back to her phone conversation. Unfazed, Sarah stopped by the bowling alley where Heather's mother worked the next day, where she revealed Brandon's true identity. Heather's mother promptly kicked Brandon out of the house and insisted that he leave her daughter alone. In January 1992, at the behest of Brandon's mother, Sarah convinces the confused young man to get into the car with her, promising to take him to Hardee's. Instead, they drive to Lincoln General Hospital, where Brandon's family is waiting. There, he has a consultation with a psychiatrist, who informs Brandon he is having a sexual identity crisis. He is sent to the Lancaster County Crisis Center for 3 days of observation. After being released, Brandon was convinced to attend counseling sessions, which he found absolutely embarrassing, as he did not wish to discuss his sexuality in front of his mother and sister. At one point, it's been reported, Joanne asked her son point blank if he were a lesbian, to which Brandon replied, "That is disgusting." He went on to elaborate, saying that he had homosexual friends in Lincoln, but had refused to go to parties with them, as he could not be with a woman the way another woman could. That he could only be with them the way a man could, because he felt like a man trapped inside of a woman's body. Brandon and his sister's past abuse came to light during these counseling sessions, when Brandon confided in his mother that he had been raped at the age of 10 by their uncle. This revelation seems to have had some long-lasting effects on the family, as Brandon refused to discuss anything further with her psychiatrists, and Joanne was mortified by the revelation. Eventually, Brandon refused to attend any more sessions after his counselors labeled him a compulsive liar. During the next 3 years of his life, Brandon bounced from house to house, staying with upwards of 19 different individuals, while his behavior continued to grow erratic and troublesome. There were many reports of theft, forgery of checks, abusing friendships by running up phone bills and other large purchases without the owners knowing. These in turn led to run-ins with the law, with Brandon being charged at least 18 times with various offenses. Intermingled with all of this were a slew of different girlfriends, each who was convinced that Brandon was, in fact, a man. One of which, a young woman named Gina, that Brandon supposedly proposed to. As the story goes, Brandon threw a large party to celebrate the announcement of their coming nuptials, at which point Gina confronted Brandon with rumors she had heard that Brandon was in fact a girl. Brandon eventually confided that although born a girl, he had undergone a surgery in Omaha, showing off his small breasts as proof of the matter, and explaining that they would eventually go away completely. The relationship eventually soured and then ended when Brandon refused to get a mastectomy. Feeling hurt, he went and stole Gina's credit card and purchased her a ring. Apparently, this led to a massive fight between the two of them, their only real one of their relationship, and Gina called it quits. Brandon continued to write Gina letters, although she never responded. Shortly afterwards, Brandon fled Lincoln. He moved 2 hours away to Humboldt, where he stayed in a farmhouse with two friends. In December, Brandon began dating 19-year-old Lana Tisdale, whom he had met at a party in Falls City. Apparently, it was a fairly whirlwind relationship. So much so that two of Lana's ex-boyfriends, 22-year-old John Lauder and 21-year-old Tom Nissen, even became enamored by Brandon. Falls City was an extremely economically depressed area. Even still, the Tisdales, Lauders, and Neesons stood out like sore thumbs. Lana Tisdale was born one of six children to Linda Gutierrez, who supported her brood on $336 a month, which she got from disability after having been stabbed by an ex-husband. To Brandon, who had been running for so long in his short life, it seemed he had met an idyllic situation, that heaven had fallen right into his lap. However, he couldn't have been more wrong, as Fall Rivers, as many areas of the country back in 1993, was close-minded to the point of being openly violent when confronted with someone or thing that went against their views of reality. Before we get to the beginning of the end of Brandon's life, I want to describe John Lauder and his friend Tom Nissen. John Lauder lived with his family in a small three-bedroom house and by all accounts was a drunk dropout derelict. John was away from his family often growing up, spending time in various foster homes. He returned to Fall City in 1990, at which point he began dating Lana. He has been described as a foul-tempered individual who was easily set off by the actions of others. Although he had not dated Lana in a number of years at the time of our story, he was still extremely devoted to her, often telling friends he would do anything for her. Tom Nissen was described in a similar manner by those who knew him. Tom had had a very troubled childhood, living up until the time he was 13 with his father in Mississippi before moving back to live with his mother Sharon near Falls City. He was a habitual runaway who had spent time in a mental institution. To quote his mother from an article on the case, "I don't know what it is. If he'd done something wrong or if he were mad at you, he'd just stand and let you scream at him. He was never violent except to himself. He shot himself in the shoulder and blamed someone else. If he saw you with all his clothes off, you'd think he'd been in an accident. There were scars all over his body. 3 years ago, he cut his arm so badly with a butcher knife they had to take him to a plastic surgeon." Seems like Tom was suffering from some sort of mental illness or depression. When he was 19, he married a woman named Candy Gibson, who gave birth to a daughter named Tiffany not long after. The following year, 1992, Tom did 9 months in jail after burning down a neighbor's house and garage. While he was in jail, he got his GED, and upon coming out, learned that his wife was pregnant with their second child. It was around this time that he met John Lauder. It was through John that he began a relationship with Lana's 18-year-old aunt, before moving on to Lana herself. Which, I'm not really poking fun at the people of Fall Rivers, but there seems to be a lot of what us here in the North would look at as somewhat incestuous type relationships. I know technically it's not, as it's a aunt and her niece, but it's still quite weird that he would go from dating the aunt to the niece. It's just my two cents on the matter. And believe me, I'm about to describe these two individuals in a much worse light. To look at pictures of the two of them, they were what you would imagine a stereotypical redneck would be. Lauder had thinning long brown hair, while Nissen had blonde hair cut into a mullet. And if you can see this thing, it's a pretty epic 1980s mullet. Their personalities weren't that far off from the idea of the stereotypical redneck either. Both men have been described as confrontational, deceptive, they like to throw their weight around and let, you know, everyone around them know that, you know, they were the man, so to speak. They tried to present themselves as good old boys. There's a saying I used to use to describe certain classless people that I would encounter, and I think it's really fitting here. Nissen and Lotter are, to me, what would happen when cousins fuck. I mean, they're that low down on the evolutionary chart. You look at them, watch interviews with them, it's obvious that these two are very uncouth, uneducated, low IQ'd individuals who have nothing but bad for the world around them. They look and act like they would feel right at home with Kid Rock's crew in the movie Joe Dirt. That's assuming that that crew didn't look down their noses at these two guys. They both considered Lana to be somewhat of their property, and Brandon's undoing began on December 15th when he went to court on a charge of underage possession of alcohol. He presented the fake ID he carried, and somehow it was discovered that he had forged a check. Brandon ended up being jailed for 8 days in a woman's cell, and it was during this time that his friends learned the truth of his identity. Now, there's some conflicting reports on what happened next. Some people say that Brandon confided to Lana that he was a hermaphrodite. Lana herself has disavowed this story. At any rate, Lana did visit Brandon in the jail cell. She was confused and torn over what to do. From one hand, she actually cared deeply for Brandon, but on the other hand, if it was true that Brandon was a woman, then she did not want to continue the relationship. Lana went so far as to attempt to post bail for Brandon, which was blocked by Lana's mother. Lana went around through a back door using a unsigned check her father had given her for a perm to post bail for her lover. And here's where the twist in the case comes, because Lana was under the age of 21, and she needed to have somebody of that age post the bail for her. She turned to her friend Tom Nissen. In later interviews, Nissen claimed that the deal he worked out with Brandon was that he would post the bail provided that Brandon proved to him what sex Brandon actually was. Relationship greatly disturbed Lana's family, and they briefly considered having her committed to a psychiatric hospital for observation. At any rate, on Christmas Eve, a party was thrown at the Neeson house, which was in the middle of Falls City. Supposedly, according to Lotter and Neeson, neither of them believed that Lana knew Brandon was actually a woman, and they questioned her over this fact, to which Lana is supposed to have replied that it didn't matter to her what Brandon actually was. This set off both Lotter and Nissen, and they grabbed Brandon, dragging him along with Lana into a bathroom. Tom held Brandon's arm behind his back, at which point John ripped off the young man's pants and forced Lana to look at what was there. After sharing a laugh over the young man's humiliation, eventually the partygoers dispersed and went to a bar. Brandon and Lana walked down the street, and Brandon called his roommates to come pick him up. Lotter and Neeson then arrived and informed Lana that her mother wanted her to go home. Lana is reported to have said she would be back in a moment, to which Brandon begged her not to leave him. Around midnight, the dawn of Christmas morning, Lotter and Neeson dragged Brandon back to the Neeson home. What happened next is taken from court records. While Lotter looked on, Tom Nissen began to beat Brandon, punching him in the face, chest, kicking him in the back, knocking him to the ground. Later, the chief of the Falls City's Police Department, Norman Hemmerling, would testify that Brandon had a welt shaped like the sole of a boot on his back. According to Lana's friends, the two men told Brandon they were angry he had ripped off their friends, and that Lana had used her parents' money to get Brandon out of jail, for which she was now in big trouble. The scene that played out next was like something out of a horror movie. Brandon was forced into Lauder's Crown Victoria, with him sitting in between the two thugs as they began to drive around Fall City. John Lauder is quoted as saying, "I'm gonna fuck you, bitch. I'm gonna show you what it feels like to be a woman." To which Brandon is supposed to have replied, "Come on, it doesn't have to be like this." They eventually got the car stuck in a ditch, and Brandon got out to help Nissen jack the car up so they could get it unstuck. The two of them went for a small walk, at which point Nissen found a farmhouse with a light on. He went back to the car and informed Lauder of what he had seen. Brandon was concealed in the back while the farmer came to help. According to Nissen, they drove for a while before pulling in behind a pig buying station, at which time they attacked Brandon. The following are quotes from Tom Nissen. "You can either have the shit beat out of you or not, and then have it happen anyway." They then raped Brandon. Nissen went on, "I went first, then John. I think it just sort of happened. I'd never done it before. I don't know that it wasn't more of an ego thing. I felt like I'd been fucked. Me and Brandon had a long conversation that evening in the bathroom. I told him, 'I don't have anything against you. If you had just been straight with me, I would have understood.' Brandon started to feed me another line how he was going to have a sex operation. John was really upset with the whole situation. Maybe he still wished he was going out with Lana. Later that morning, Brandon showed up at the Tisdale's front door, bleeding, covered in mud, and barefoot. He was taken to a hospital, after which he called his sister, Tammy, and explained everything that had happened to him. At the end of the conversation, Brandon is reported to have told his sister, 'I didn't cry the whole time. I wasn't going to give them the satisfaction.'" From here, the plot thickens quite a bit. Charles Locks, the Richardson County Sheriff, showed up at the hospital that afternoon and began to interrogate Brandon. You can find copies of this interrogation online. And he is very condescending and almost seems uncaring in the way he handles Brandon. He almost seems to be mocking him. It was during this interrogation that Brandon informed Locks that he had been threatened with death should he go to the police with what had happened to him. This has been verified on by a number of different sources, including Joanne, Brandon's mother, who said she had called the state police and even Locks numerous times asking if an arrest had been made in connection with her daughter's rape, further pressing upon them that the two men had threatened to kill Brandon if anything was said to law enforcement. They informed her that they were investigating the allegations and would take appropriate actions once they had completed. Now, there's a lot of things that went on in this case which don't make a whole lot of sense. The Falls River Hospital stated in their report that Tina had been raped, although Locks claimed he found inconsistency in Brandon's statements, such as that he had been raped once, that he had been raped twice, that both men had beaten him, and that only Tom had partaken in the beating. Another law enforcement official, Deputy Sheriff Tom Obering, who is a friend of John Lauder, saw Brandon that day as well, and claimed later that it was obvious what had happened, adding, "You have to get statements from both sides, though. You can't just go around arresting people." Wouldn't be until 3 days later, on December 28th, when Lauder and Nissen were questioned. Both men denied the allegations, although Nissen did admit to hearing Brandon say, "Don't hurt me," shortly before Brandon's clothing was removed. Now, I had to do a little digging to find out exactly why Brandon stayed in Fall Rivers given what had happened, but apparently he told his family he had a few things to take care of before he left the area and returned to Lincoln, such as a court appearance on the 31st. He informed his family of where it could be reached.
That Thursday, December 30th, police believed they had enough information to proceed with their arrests for the assault and rape of Brandon. They placed a report calling for the men's arrest on the desk of County Attorney Douglas Mers.
Mers, who had been in court all day, said that it would have to wait until the following morning. Later, at trial, a few facts were gleaned. The gun the men had used to kill the three victims belonged to one Eddie Bennett, who was a friend of John Lotter. They had gotten the gun from him shortly before committing the murders. Lotter was said to have been extremely intoxicated at the time of the murders. Heading to the house, they had no idea that Lana's sister had fought with her boyfriend, Philip Devine, that day, and that he had gone to stay with Brandon and Lisa. Around 1 a.m., Lotter and Nissen left Bennett's home and drove to the house of Lana Tisdale. They inquired about Brandon's whereabouts, and Lana's mother informed them of where the young man was staying. They then informed Lana that they were going out to kill somebody that night, putting a knife into them, and afterwards, she would be next. Lana later testified that she didn't think to call the farmhouse to warn them of what was coming or call the police. In testimony, Neeson said, "Basically, we said, let's go scare the shit out of them. From the way events took place, I would say John probably had a plan. There wasn't much conversation. The murders took me by surprise, as it wasn't something we had discussed beforehand. This is the way it went, okay? John kicked in the door and we entered the residence. I found a light in the living room and turned it on. We entered Lisa Lambert's bedroom. Lisa had picked up the phone and was trying to call someone. John took the phone out of her hand and hung it up. There was a waterbed in the bedroom, and Brandon was on the floor at the end of the bed, covered by a blanket, hiding. I pulled Brandon off the floor and sat on the edge of the bed. Lisa said to me, 'Tom, don't let him hurt me,' because John had the gun. I was kind of surprised when she said my name. I'd never met her, but she knew me because she had seen me around, I guess. I don't recall even a whimper from Brandon. Brandon was shot then, both times. I don't know how to put it into words, to be honest with you. If I had known they were going to be killed, I think I would have run the car off the road into a telephone pole on the way there, killed us instead, but I couldn't have just turned back. It was kind of a matter of pride." Now, something that's not often portrayed in any of the films or other media associated with this case is Brandon's skull had been crushed,
and he'd also been found with a knife wound in the liver.
Nissen elaborated on that. "The report that her skull was crushed, that was caused by a bullet entering her head. The stabbing, well, that was me. It just kind of happened all so fast, I couldn't tell if she was already dead. I honestly don't know. Were you ever caught up in a moment before?"
And something I'd want to clarify real quick is I'm not reading Tom Nissen's words in an attempt to glorify him, but his account is possibly the closest we'll ever know to what happened that night. And while he did give another account at a much later date, at that point, it was really to try and get John off of death row, so I think it can really be discounted. This is probably the closest we will ever get to the truth of what happened. Although we should take into account that at this point that the statement was given, Tom Nissen was trying to paint himself in the best light possible, given the circumstances. Nissen said that after the gun had been fired, the baby started crying, and he picked the child up, trying to calm him down. Lisa asked for her baby, and Tom reportedly said yes, he would give it to her. The gun was then fired again at Lisa. She was hit in the stomach. The baby was placed back into the crib, and then Lisa was shot in the face. Nissen then stated that he went and grabbed Philip from another room, at which point Philip began to scream that he didn't see anything and wouldn't tell anyone what had happened. Philip was walked into the living room and sat on the couch, at which time he was shot twice. In an interview given after trial, Nissen elaborated on his thoughts that night. "I thought about my kids and my wife. I do believe that if I had to do it again, over again, I would have stood in front of Lisa and taken her bullet. Brandon didn't deserve to die either, but I don't feel real guilt about killing her. I think she probably would have been killed by someone anyway." And that shows you the mentality of both of these men. Neither of them feel any remorse for what happened. And it goes to show you the character of both of them. Later that morning, Lisa's mother discovered the three bodies after she became worried about not having heard from her daughter. At 5 that afternoon, the police pulled up to Tom Nissen's house and found both Tom and John in the front room playing cards. Both men were arrested. The gun used in the killing, as well as a knife, were found the next day on a frozen Namaha River just off of Highway 73. John Lauder was charged with murder, kidnapping, and sexual assault. Tom Nissen was charged with murder, kidnapping, and aiding and abetting the assault. At trial, Tom Nissen accused John Lauder of committing the murders, and in exchange for a reduced sentence, admitted to being an accessory to the rape and murder. He was later sentenced to life in prison. Lauder was found guilty of the murder and received the death penalty. There have been a few twists and turns since their convictions. In September of 07, Nissen recanted his testimony against Lauder, claiming that he was the one who shot the three of them, this in an attempt to get Lauder's death sentence vacated. This was later used in Lauder's appeals. To date, none of the appeals have gone through, including three that were petitioned to the United States Supreme Court. Nissen sits in a Nebraska prison while Lauder awaits his execution. Brandon Tina was buried in the Lincoln Memorial Cemetery in Lincoln, Nebraska, his headstone inscribed with his birth name. His mother, Joanne, refusing to accept the identity her daughter had gone under for most of his adult life. That's it for the Deathcast this week. I'd like to thank you all for riding through the crypt with me. I don't have a book of the week to recommend this week. However, if you want to learn more about this story, there's a very good documentary called The Brandon Tina Story that was released, I think, in the late 90s, and that's what introduced me to the life and death of Brandon Tina. It's a very well-done documentary, and I can't recommend it enough. Also, I used a couple of different sources this week, the largest one being a piece that appeared in Playboy magazine covering the life and murder of Brandon Tina. It's entitled Death of a Deceiver by Eric Tonsberg. If you can find it online, it's worth the read. One quick cheap little plug for a friend of mine. If you are looking for something lighthearted to read during these stressful times, the Craig Banyan books by James Mullaney are well worth the investment. They are exceedingly well written. He's the kind of author I wish I could write like. They are very enjoyable, hilarious reads. Until next week, stay morbid, my friends. Thank you.
Welcome to the Deadcast.